Hello and welcome to another episode of Macabre for Mortals. This week I will be covering the decade of the 1920s in our series of unsolved murders. The two cases I'm going to cover is one of William Desmond Taylor and also the Hinterkaifeck murders, which both happened in the year of 1922. Considering that these cases were both 101 years ago, we have to understand the limitations of the forensic science that was available at the time, and also how the availability to move across borders, or also the availability of the criminal to change their identity so easily, that was all something that needs to be considered. I will be starting off with the case of William Desmond Taylor. It was a thriller plot fit for the movies. A famous film director mysteriously murdered in his home, and for extra glamour, some of the suspects were genuine stars of the silver screen. And for extra spice, William Desmond Taylor had a secret past. The name William Desmond Taylor is no longer familiar to modern moviegoers. In the 1910s and 1920s, he was a prolific director whose name routinely appeared in the gossip columns alongside that of one of the most beautiful actresses or another. He worked with legends of the silent film era, Mary Pickford, Myrtle Stedman, and Wallace Reid, and lived in a stylish bungalow in a sought-after Los Angeles movie colony neighborhood. To his Hollywood friends, William Desmond Taylor seemed to have it made. Such was the case until the morning hours of the 2nd of February 1922, when Taylor's valet and cook, Henry Peavy, found his lifeless body laying face up on the floor in his study. Peavy ran screaming from the bungalow into the apartment building's courtyard. At first, it appeared that the 49-year-old director must have succumbed to natural causes. His suit was unmarked, said a neighbour, the actor Douglas McLean, who rushed to William's home as soon as he heard Peavy's cries. He was lying flat on his back, his feet separated a little, his hands at his side, perfectly flat on his back, McLean commented. I said to Mrs. McLean later on, he looked like a dummy in a department store, just so perfect and so immaculate. Movie mogul Adolf Zucker, president of famous Players Lasky Hollywood's preeminent studio, was desperate to hush up the potential scandal of Taylor's death. Before the police arrived, he sent employees around to Taylor's house to remove any bootleg liquor or compromising material, and they also told Peavy to clean up the crime scene. The industry had recently suffered several blows, such as rape and murder charges of comedy star Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle, whose third trial loomed as Taylor lay dead. Robbery clearly was not the motive, as Taylor still had $78 in his wallet. As soon as the police turned the dead man over, it was obvious that Taylor had not died a natural death. He was laying in a pool of blood, with a bullet wound in his back. From the angle of the wound, the gun had probably been fired by someone standing just over 1.5 metres tall, that's just 5 foot, possibly while embracing Taylor. William Desmond Taylor's murder would become one of Hollywood's darkest legends, with every twist and turn of the investigation lapped up by the press. Gossip peddlers would not have wished for better material. Unfortunately, for the actress Mabel Normand, the police's inevitable first step was to suspect whoever last saw the victim. Considered one of the top comedians of the era, Mabel had a huge expressive eyes and dark hair cropped flapper style. By 1922, she was working for Goldwyn Studios for about $1,000 a week, the equivalent of about $15,000 today. She also had a drug and drinking problem, coincidentally perhaps, as Taylor was famously on a crusade to rid Hollywood of drugs. Mabel Normand had worked alongside legends such as Charlie Chaplin, Harold Lloyd, and the aforementioned Fatty Arbuckle. Normand denied knowing anything about the murder and claiming that her visit was completely innocent. Taylor had bought her a book and called her to pick it up, and she arrived between 7 and 7:15 p.m. They talked about literature and theatre, and then after half an hour together, he walked her to her car and they waved goodbye. "Please tell the public that I did not know anything about this terrible thing that's happening, that Mr. Taylor and I did not quarrel," she said in a press statement. A locket with Mabel's picture and an inscription, "To my dearest," was found in Taylor's belonging. After being repeatedly questioned, Mabel Normand was dismissed as an official suspect, although a cloud of suspicion remained over her. As recently as 1990, the author Robert Grideau put forth a theory that William's determination to help Mabel beat her cocaine addiction angered her drug dealers, so they killed him in revenge. Also, coincidentally, in 1924, Mabel's name was once more linked to a murder, her chauffeur, R.C. Greer, as he confessed to shooting wealthy oilman C.S. Dines. And in a 1930 interview in the Los Angeles Record, PV, so that's Taylor's chauffeur, actually claimed that Mabel Normand was Taylor's murderer. Search newspaper mentions of William Desmond Taylor's in the months leading up to his death, and nearly every story includes the name of 19-year-old up-and-coming actress Mary Miles Minter. Born Juliet Riley in 1902 in Shreveport, Louisiana, Mary was a doe-eye beauty in the mold of Mary Pickford, although 10 years younger. Taylor had directed Mary in the 1919 silent film Anne of Green Gables, in which she played the title role, and he was known to be invested in her career. After his death, investigators found the love letters from Mary among Taylor's effects. The notes were written in a silly code known to thousands of youngsters. One read, "I put something soft and flowing. I'd wait to find two strong arms and two dear lips pressed on mine in a long, sweet kiss." This implied a far more intimate relationship than even Taylor's closest friends had realized. While Mary's mother tried to downplay her daughter's declarations, saying that Mary loved William as a child would her father, Mary herself said otherwise, referring to him as the love of her life. "I loved him deeply, with all the admiration and respect a young girl gives to a man with his poise and unfailing culture." Reporters latched on to Mary's romantic revelations, painting her as a both virginal and a temptress, a young woman who mistook William's kindness as something more. No evidence surfaced that he ever returned Mary's love, and after his death, the rumor was that he was actually gay or bisexual. One typically lurid story in the New York Daily News reported that William engaged in unmannerly rituals as part of an optimal cult. Taylor and Minter's secret relationship was enough to warrant an interrogation. The fact that she had no alibi and the police believed three long blonde hairs found on Taylor's jacket were hers. In 1937, 15 years after the murder, police made it clear that Mary was still a prime suspect when they subpoenaed her, her mother and her sister, claiming they had uncovered new evidence. Mary publicly demanded that authorities should either clear her name or try her for the murder. Neither ever happened. Nevertheless, Mary has remained a suspect. The writer Charles Higham suggests that this in his book Murder in Hollywood, Solving a Silent Screen Mystery, that Mary was jealous of his affairs with other women and men. Higham posits that the night of the killing, Mary turned up at William's home with a gun and threatened to kill herself if he would not return her love. He calmed her down, but she was still holding the gun as they embraced and accidentally shot him. As quickly as Mary Miles Minter's name hit the headlines as a possible suspect, so did her mother. Charlotte Shelby had been a Shakespearean actress who had appeared on Broadway in at least one production, but her stardom fell as she raised two daughters, Mary and Margaret Fillmore. By some accounts, there was no love lost between Charlotte and William Desmond Taylor. Charlotte's former secretary told district attorney attached to the case that she heard Charlotte tell Taylor, "If I ever see you hanging around my Mary again, I'll blow your goddamn brains out." On the surface, it would seem ludicrous to think that Charlotte would want Taylor dead. He was, after all, shepherding her daughter's career and thus helping the whole family financially. Some commentators posit that Charlotte was merely a protective mother trying to shield her young daughter from a man nearly three times her age. Mary herself rebuffed that notion. "Mother's actions over Mr. Taylor's attentions to me were not inspired by a desire to protect me from him. She was really trying to shove me into the background so she could monopolize his attention and, if possible, his love." Even more damning were the comments and court testimony provided by Charlotte's older daughter, Margaret. According to her, neither Mary nor Charlotte was home between 7 and 9 p.m. on the night of the murder. Mary eventually arrived in a hysterical condition, while Charlotte did not come home at all. "I knew she was out all day and night hunting for a certain man to learn Mary's whereabouts. She later came in and told us that Taylor died." Margaret told police that her mother had tossed the gun into the river Kansas City. Soon after, Charlotte and Margaret were committed into a psychiatric ward. Both Mary and Margaret would publicly battle their domineering mother in separate court actions the years after Taylor's death. Beyond the daughters' incriminating statements about Charlotte's possible role in Taylor's death, police uncovered convincing circumstantial evidence against the matriarch. She allegedly owned both the type of gun and the rare soft noise ammunition used in the killing. While this is not enough to convince a grand jury, it was plenty enough to convince Ed King, one of the lead investigators on the case, who went to his grave believing Charlotte Shelby had gotten away with murder. The list of suspects does not end with Charlotte Shelby. Suspicion also surrounds the dead man's chauffeur and his own brother. The roots of this theory lay in Taylor's early life, one he abandoned 14 years before his death. He was born in 1872, not as William Desmond Taylor, but William Cunningham Dean Tanner, the elder son of a wealthy landowner and grandson of a member of parliament. William was raised in Mallow Island with a younger brother named Dennis Gage Dean Tanner. William longed to become an actor, and disappointed by his family refusing him to join the army, joining a theatre group in Manchester, he did this instead. He bounced around the UK and then Canada before landing in New York, where Dennis joined him. The two opened an antique shop on Fifth Avenue. In 1901, at the age of 29, William married Ethel Harrison, the niece of a real estate tycoon, and the two had a daughter named Ethel Daisy. In 1908, William is said to have emptied his bank account and vanished, leaving no forwarding address for his wife and child. Ethel was granted a divorce on charges of adultery 4 years after William had left her. And Ethel would eventually learn that her husband had moved to Hollywood, where she and her daughter saw him on the silver screen using a new name. 4 years after William disappeared, so did his brother, Dennis, in a similar fashion. His wife said he left the house with his hat and walking stick as though he was going to work, never to return. Neither his wife nor his two small children ever heard from him again. Taylor reconnected with his daughter shortly before his death. She told reporters that her father's letter were filled with mentions of Mary Miles Minter, and Taylor's daughter inherited his entire estate after debts were paid off, totaling nearly $19,000, over $270,000 in the US today. Sometime in 1920, Taylor hired a man called Edward Sands to be his chauffeur. A year before his murder, he and Sands had a falling out, as Taylor accused the chauffeur of stealing from him and threatening to have him arrested. Sands disappeared shortly before the shooting and was sought by police as a potential suspect. All this serves as a backdrop to one of the more convoluted theories surrounding Taylor's death: that Dennis had assumed the identity of Edward Sands after the falling out with his more successful brother had shot him. This theory even made the newspapers, as evidenced by a 1936 Associated Press story that asked, "Was the Edward Sands who presumably acted as his valet really his brother, Dennis?" Abandoned his ex-wife Ada, tried to clear his name, insisting that the brothers were much, very much devoted to each other, and providing police with photos, documents, and handwriting samples. Neither Dennis nor Sands ever resurfaced, however, so the conjecture continues. Taylor's neighbor, Faith McLean, had said that she saw a man leaving Taylor's home on the night of the murder. In 1964, 42 years after the elusive killer struck, a woman named Pat Lewis declared on her deathbed that she had killed William. On its own, this confession would not have meant much. Police claimed that the case had garnered some 300 confessions within the first 6 weeks of the investigation. But a family friend did some digging and found there was perhaps something to Pat Lewis's claims. Lewis had once been known as Patricia Palmer, and before that, she had achieved some movie star fame as Margaret Gibby Gibson. Margaret Gibson starred alongside William Desmond Taylor in four movies in 1914. No subsequent contact has ever been unequivocally established. And in 1923, 21 months after Taylor's murder, Margaret Gibson was arrested for blackmailing a contractor in Burbank. But by 1964, she was a recluse living in a small house in the Hollywood Hills. When she suffered a heart attack, she demanded a priest and began confessing her sins, namely that while she was in the silent screen actress, she had shot and killed William Desmond Taylor. And she continued by saying that they nearly caught her and she had to flee the country. Bruce Long, author of William Desmond Taylor, A Dossier, hypothesized in the same newsletter that Gibson had, like Mary, fallen in love with William, ultimately killing him in a "if I can't have him, then no one can" frenzy. William J. Mann, author of Tinseltown, Murder, Morphine, and Madness at the Dawn of Hollywood, suggests that the actress was trying to blackmail Taylor over the family he had abandoned and had recruited help from a local crime boss, Blackie Marston, known as the blackmailer Don Osborne. Mann posits that one of those men, rather than Gibson herself, pulled the trigger. However, unlike in the movies, this compelling mystery would surely have a clear ending. However, it became clear long ago that the murder of William Desmond Taylor will never have a satisfying third act. I'll now be moving into the second case, the Hinterkaifeck murders, also in 1922. Few unsolved murders encompass so many dark secrets and raise so many disturbing questions as this lurid, spooky tale of incest, jealousy, and mystery. Hinterkaifeck was the name of a small, isolated farmstead situated in the beautiful rolling hills and forests between the towns of Ingolstadt and Schrobrunn in Bavaria, Germany. It was the home of Andreas Gruber, 63, his wife Cecilia, 72, their widowed daughter Victoria Gabriel, 35, and her children Cecilia, 7, and Joseph, 2, and also their new maid, Maria Baumgartner, 44. In the dead of night on the 31st of March 1922, someone systematically slaughtered each member of the family one by one and piled their bodies in a barn. Andreas Gruber was not a popular man in the community. He was thought to be aggressive and greedy, and people in the nearby village generally avoided him. Victoria was the only child of Andreas and Casilla to have survived into adulthood. Locals speculated that their other children had perished because they were not looked after properly and were treated cruelly. The small children had to stay in the cellar for days. When you passed by, you could hear children crying, a neighbor recalled. Even more damaging to Andreas's reputation was the public knowledge that he was having an incestuous relationship with Victoria, whose husband Carl Gabriel had died in France in 1914 during World War I. After his death, Andreas and Victoria were convicted of incest between the years of 1907 and 1910. Victoria was sentenced to 1 month and Andreas to 1 year in prison. And it was also rumoured that Andreas was the real father of little Josef and not the village mayor, Lorenz Schittenbauer, with whom Victoria had also been having an intimate relationship at the time that she became pregnant. Lorenz had reportedly wanted to marry Victoria, but he had been stopped by Andreas, who had angrily chased him away from the farm with a scythe. Princess Riga, the groom's maid before Maria Baumgartner, later told police that she had overheard Andreas telling Victoria that she does not need to marry because as long as he lives, he is there for this. The maid claimed that by this, Andreas was alluding to the fact that he was there to sexually satisfy his daughter, so she didn't need a husband. In the days leading up to the murders, Andreas told neighbors about some odd occurrences that had been unfolding at the farm. A Munich newspaper was discovered on the kitchen windowsill, which the family found peculiar because it was not a local newspaper. When Andreas questioned the postman, Joseph Mayer, about it, he denied he had delivered the newspaper to anybody in the area. When Andreas looked out at the snow-covered farmland, he noticed footprints leading from the edge of the nearby dark forest to the farm, but none leading back. Was there a trespasser? Was someone watching the family? Krizenz Reiger certainly thought so. While working at the farm, she was so convinced that somebody or something was lurking in the shadows of the forest that just months before the murders, she packed her bags and fled, never to return. At around the same time, the house keys disappeared from Andreas's desk, and somebody attempted to break into the engine yard. Andreas also voiced concerns that the livestock was missing and someone was creeping around in his attic. Over the course of several nights, he heard strange noises coming from above, but when he went to investigate, he found nothing. His neighbor urged him to go to the police, but Andreas refused, saying, "I know how to defend myself." While these incidents were cause for concern, nobody could have expected what happened next. And from the 1st of April 1922, the entire group of families seemed to have vanished. Kazilia did not appear at school that day, a Saturday, and the family did not attend church on Sunday. The postman noticed that the letters that he had delivered on Saturday were left untouched, and Victoria sang in the church choir, so her absence was particularly noticed. Three neighbours decided to investigate. Discovering that all of the doors were locked, they broke into the barn adjoining the farmhouse. Daylight penetrating the murky barn illuminated the ghastly sight of the bludgeoned bodies of Andreas, his wife Kazilia, Victoria, and her daughter Kazilia, piled up among the hay. From the barn, the neighbours were able to enter the farmhouse, where they found the lifeless bodies of the maid Maria and little Joseph. Each of the six victims suffered fatal blows to the head. The police concluded that the first four victims had been lured out one by one to the barn and murdered before they could even cry out. The killers stacked their bodies one on top of the other and partially covered them with hay and an old door that had been dumped in the barn. Then he went into the farmhouse where he killed Joseph, who was sleeping in his cot, and Maria, and he covered their bodies with clothing and sheets. Each victim had been bludgeoned with a mattock, a pickaxe-like farming tool, on the face and the head. The elder Kazilia also showed signs of strangulation. And while the majority died quick, a bit vicious death, the younger Kazilia took several hours to die. Sadly, the new housekeeper, Maria, had just started work at the Hinterkaifeck farm that very day. The pathologist estimated that the murders took place at around 9:30 p.m. on the 31st of March, and furthermore that the killer did not immediately flee the grisly scene. He remained on the farm for several days, feeding and milking the livestock and helping himself to bread and ham from the pantry. Neighbours had later claimed that they had seen smoke coming from the farmhouse chimney, and the family dog had been tied up in the barn but was unharmed. The Scrobenhausen police were called in to assist the investigation, but after realizing that they were in over their heads, much more experienced Munich force took over the case. Their initial theory was that the killer was a vagrant, motivated by the family's considerable wealth. However, a search of the farm indicated that gold coins and jewelry had been untouched, and no belongings or livestock were missing. More than 100 suspects were questioned over the course of the investigation, and when police questioned local residents, the name Joseph Bartel came to their attention. Bartel was a serial robber who had once escaped a mental asylum. In 1919, he had robbed the Alder family in the small village of Ettenhausen, about 13 miles or 21 kilometres from Hinterkaifeck. Many speculated that only a madman like Josef would have remained at the crime scene, living alongside the bloody bodies of his victims for so many days. However, other than most tenacious circumstantial evidence, nothing tied him to the crime. Mayor Lorenz Schittelbauer, who was once wanted to marry Victoria, and possibly Father Josef, was a prime suspect throughout the investigation. He was one of the three neighbours who discovered the bodies, and he lived the closest to the Hinterkaifeck farm. It was reported that when neighbours came across the dog, it took a particular disliking to Schittenbauer, barking at him the entire time when he was in the barn. He had also clashed violently with Andreas over his relationship with Victoria, and had even reported them to the authorities for their incestuous relationship. According to the other neighbours on the scene, Schlittenbauer was also said to be remarkably unfazed when the Gruber's bodies were discovered, despite the gruesome nature of what they found. Admittedly, his outwardly calm behavior could have been attributed to shock. Lorenz Schlittenbauer was interrogated at the crime scene on the 5th of April 1922. At the time of the murders, he claimed he was a happily married man with no motive for killing the entire Gruber family. But nevertheless, even today, Schlittenbauer remains the favourite suspect along the town's fate of Inchelstadt. Schlittenbauer's family still lives in the town and still has to endure the whispers and speculation that he was a killer, even though his son Alonis pointed out there has never been an indictment. One of the more outlandish suspects was Victoria's ex-husband Carl Gabriel, who had supposedly died in the trenches in 1914. His body was never actually retrieved, leading the Schrossenhausen chief police, Ludwig Mixel, to suggest that perhaps Gabriel had not died after all. If he had survived, he could have travelled to Hinterkaifeck and committed the murders, perhaps in revenge for his wife's incestuous affair with her father. However, on the 12th of December 1923, Carl Gabriel's death was officially confirmed by the Central Prosecution Office for war losses and war graves, and he was officially ruled out as a suspect in the case. Another surprising suspect was the cruel and controlling head of the family, Andreas Gruber herself. Author Adolf Jakob Koppel argued in an article in the Munich newspaper Azimbung that the mattock used to kill the victim was handmade by Gruber himself and would have been difficult for an untrained person to wield with such deadly efficiency. However, this theory fails to explain how Andreas could have inflicted such fatal injuries on himself. 20 years later, in a 1941 confession, an elderly neighbour, Kristen Meyer, made his deathbed confession to her priest, Anton Halber. She stated that her brothers, Adolf and Anton Gump, were responsible for the Hinterkaifeck murders. She explained that her oldest brother, Adolf, had been in an intimate relationship with Victoria and had been infuriated when he became of Victoria and Andreas' Gruber's incestuous relationship. According to Krenzia Meyer, Adolf and Anton had killed Victoria and Andreas Gruber and then dispatched everyone else living at the farm to ensure that there would be no witnesses to reveal their crime. However, it was not until 1952 that the police decided to investigate the brothers' possible guilt. And by this time, Adolf had been dead for 8 years, and Anton was an elderly pensioner who categorically denied any involvement in the murders. He was arrested, but after 3 weeks in custody, was released without charge. The combination of the unexplained footprints in the snow leading from the forest to the farm and the mysterious sounds apparently coming from the attic paint a frightening picture of a sadistic intruder hiding in the house and waiting for his moment to strike. This picture continues to fascinate the professional and amateur sleuths many decades after the slayings. However, the sheer lack of evidence, incomplete case records, and the deaths of potential witnesses and suspects means that it's very doubtful that the mystery of the Hinterkaifeck murders will ever be solved. During the chaos of World War II, a significant number of police files were destroyed. In addition, all six of the victims' heads, which had been sent to the Pathology Institute of the University of Munich for analysis, also disappeared. 1 year after the mass murders at Hinterkaifeck, a court order was given for the farmhouse and outbuildings to be demolished. A small marble monument near the original site, along with six graves for the family and their maid, is all that now remains to mark the horrors that unfolded all those years ago. Thank you for joining me for another episode of Macabre Mortals. I hope that you enjoyed these little dives into some unsolved murders. I know the Hinterkai Effect one is a one that has been covered by a lot of podcasts, so I just really wanted to touch on that one. But the other one, I hadn't really ever heard of before. So I just wanted to give a little bit of something that had happened in that decade and even that year of two very different crimes. If you have any suggestions or if you have any cases that you'd like me to cover, then please give me an email at macabremortals@gmail.com. And thank you again for listening. And wherever you are in the world, please stay safe.